Welcome to The Afterglow. The Afterglow podcast gives women, we're talking to you, the permission and tools to live life according to your own rules.
Yes, this is a platform to educate and empower women identifying humans through intriguing conversations with courageous Canadian women who are breaking down limiting beliefs and outdated rules. These women have done it, are doing it, or can provide tools for you to do the same.
We are Julie Watson
and Liz Doyle-Hermer.
And we started Afterglow, our yoga studio, after years of staying home to raise kids. Now, as podcasters, we want to help others do the same. Step into your own power. It's time to shake things up and get real about who you are and what you want.
The Afterglow is your next act. It's what came after you did what you were told and instead decided to do what was in your heart. It's how you have reinvented yourself. It's your vision for the next 40 to 50 years. It's when you took your power back. Welcome to The Afterglow. We want to be honest right off the bat and say that today's podcast is a challenging one to listen to. We cover some difficult themes, including mental illness and suicide. And we know these aren't easy topics, but we also believe that it's important we spend time learning and developing awareness around these subjects. On today's show, our guest is Lynn Keene. She is a speaker, author, former broadcast journalist, and passionate advocate for suicide prevention and mental wellness. Lynn has spent the last decade educating the public about the devastating reality of people in crisis and suicide. Her story is a personal one. Since the death of her son Daniel by suicide in 2009, Lynn Keene has dedicated her life to sharing his story, the underlying causes and contributing factors in depression and suicide, as well as the importance of treating mental illness with understanding and compassion. But far beyond the grief and the sadness, Lynn's story is truly a story of alchemy. In this podcast, you will learn how she took a traumatizing, heartbreaking experience and was able to turn it into an act of service and purpose. This is a testament to Lynn's resilience and her courage and her ability to be with the discomfort of grief. As mothers ourselves, we learned a lot about what signs to look out for, what's more than just normal teenage angst, and how we can support our children and their mental health and well-being.
Hi, Lynn. Welcome to The Afterglow.
Thank you. Thank you.
We're really happy you're here and honored to have you and inspired by your story. And Julie and I, we were just saying earlier that this might be one of the most important conversations we have on this podcast.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm humbled. I'm actually very honored. Thank you.
Yeah, well, we want to just make sure that we honor the space that you're providing for us today, because it is such an important topic. And, you know, there's so much information about this that I feel like we can have, you know, a really deep and meaningful conversation. So I want to make sure that we give it the space, we give it the time, and just, you know, honor particularly the language around it and the sensitivities around it as well. So
thank you. Thank you. That's exactly, I think, why I launched myself almost 12 years ago was just something simple as language. We as a family were bombarded just by watching anything on television. Just the language was constantly, oh, I'm going to kill myself, or I'm going to, and it, you know, even today it still exists. So everything, I think language is a really good place to start.
Mm-hmm. Well, we don't say commit suicide anymore. We say died by suicide, right? Yes, that's important to know. That's important for people to know out there, because I think if you're not affected by it, you're still kind of going with whatever you heard on TV in the old terms. And it's the same thing as like suicide completion, not killing yourself, right? So are there any other terms that we have changed that we know that we need to be sensitive about?
Right off the top, commit. Yeah. Because commit goes back to when suicide was actually illegal back in the day. And therefore the stigmatization around someone taking their life, continues to this day. So it's, as you said, died by suicide, lost through suicide. I've never said suicided. Because I've heard those phrases, but what I stick to is, my son died by suicide, lost through suicide. But commit is just, it's not someone intentionally doing it. It's just the language we've been given. Mm-hmm. And so it just denotes so much more And it again, it goes back to the old days when it used to be an illegal act. So
yeah, it's like a crime, and it's not a crime, right?
It's so interesting. And we are cavalier about language. I remember a friend of mine, her mother had died from an aneurysm, and she just said it. She took offense with that statement, that expression, "Oh, I'm going to have an aneurysm." She's like, "It's just, I wish people wouldn't say that." You know,
it's triggering, and it's just, it not only brings you back to that place, but it's just, it's also, I think over time you get angry. It's like, mm-hmm. don't you understand? We don't know what someone else is dealing with. Mm-hmm. We don't know. And I mean, for our family, and I'll see myself specifically, I thought I was an empathetic person. I thought I had a lot of compassion, but honestly, until I had to walk that road and sort of feel the feels for others. I mean, I, in fact, it gets to a point where I have to turn off things because it's such a way that I didn't feel before. Mm. And I think it's when you are just bare and you are vulnerable for a long time, it's just the way you come out of it. So I, you know, anybody that has to live through that and you know, whatever way they've either lost someone or had a terrible illness, just have to be kinder. Like, you know,
well, there's that term that if for every mother, it's like walking around with your heart outside of your body. But I imagine for you, it's like walking around with your heart, but it's just in the most completely raw state that it could possibly be in at all times now.
Time is a healer. I will say time for me, really, and I never would have thought this. I just literally wanted to not be here. You know, I have two other children. I have a husband. I have a family. I just thought, well, if we're not a family of five, then, you know, why should I, what's worth it? And again, when we were, you know, this obviously was a shock. And so people tried to help us in the sense of they would leave food at the door, which was just tremendous. Or they would send us notes, or they would send us scripture. Or they would send us all these different things, but having no knowledge of really what we needed. And really for me, as Daniel's mom, all I needed was him. So anything short of that was not enough. And as a result, I sealed myself off for almost 2 years. And is it a good thing? Probably not. I did talk to other survivors that was really helpful, like mothers and also siblings for my girls. We met up with other survivors, which was huge. And then the Toronto Distress Center got us into their 18-week program, and it was, or 8-week or however many weeks, it was a long time. And we sat with another survivor and a psychologist or a counselor. And that was the beginning of understanding that you will come out of this. I still didn't know what life looked like, or I was still, I mean, literally wore my sunglasses no matter what the weather was, because I just could not interact with another human. I didn't want to know, if you knew me, I didn't want you to know me right then. And I couldn't take on your pain of our loss, and people felt sad. But I couldn't take it on any more emotions from outside my own body. You know, if I think about it now, what I did was the right thing for me, but I didn't know it was the right thing for me. When I decided that I needed to be present in some shape for my daughters, number one, and then my husband, because that was a whole other story. Like, our relationship really changed immensely. And there was just things that came out from that. And also people saying, well, I'm sure you guys will make it. And I didn't even know what that meant, but the incidence of divorce after a traumatic experience is more than 50%. Yeah. So, and we're still together. So, but I did what was right for me. And really by sealing myself off, it allowed me to be I could feel Daniel's presence in a way that wasn't clouded by anything else. And I could see his face. I could see him smiling at me. And so then I started writing about him. And that's what led to my book, was writing about him, because I was afraid that I would forget what that looked like. What did he look like, you know, besides a photograph? But what did that smile that you can see, you know, you love somebody, you can see such a special relationship with them. And I started reading about other people's stories, just like all manner of stories around family, not necessarily our loss, but just trauma and how you work through that. And I saw a counselor for a long time. But I think for me, the sealing off and absorbing myself in the pain of what you said, Julie, was just like, you're so beyond raw. It's like the day you gave birth to your child is like that day that will live with you forever. And that day for me after losing Daniel was just, you were supposed to watch these beings get old, or at least get gray hair, maybe have a child, you know, we're supposed to be part of that. And right away, our history is ripped away. How we get through it, I don't, you know, I looked back, we're 12, we'll be 12 years on April 28th.
Just what you said about all you needed was him and you couldn't have him. And yet going through this process of grief that you went through, the writing, I know running was a part of that. We'll talk about running, getting counseling. And now you have had moments of joy. You've talked about finding joy in 2015. So what's sticking out is really your resilience and your courage to go through that process, right? Of getting through grief.
And what I would say now is that there was a point in that process, I couldn't even tell you the years when different things happened, but they were so like insignificant and they would happen just over like weeks and weeks. But the very first time I understood I didn't have to be 24/7 a griever was when I started reading. I literally had like a half an hour or an hour that I could actually literally move the grief aside and actually be absorbed in someone else's story. And then of course you'd go back, you'd go back and then you'd cry, and then crying, what led me to moments of peace. So my eyes would be, my eyes were constantly swollen, but I remember feeling somewhat lifted, not joyful yet, but lifted after crying. So the crying is such an integral part of my grief process. And I know everybody's so different. There's no counselor, no psychiatrist, nobody can say, you're going to start to feel this way. And then in 2 days, you're going to feel this way. Well, you feel it all within an hour.
Right. And then you kind of go back and repeat it all over again. Yeah. Right. And it's just the kind of this cyclical thing, and it can be months or years or right. And you kind of come back to it, like you're saying right now, when you revisit it after so much time. I just wanted to mention the name of your book is Give Sorrow Words. Right. And it sort of weaves memories of the last months of Daniel's life, and then as well as your family and recovery beyond. And so you mentioned that at some point going to the writing and writing the book was sort of another part of your self-care and recovery. And so when did that happen? Like how many years after was that?
So 2009, we lost Daniel to April of 2009. As Liz mentioned, I started running pretty quick. Like I got back to running pretty quickly after that, like just short distances, but on a run, I ended up sort of creating an essay in my head, and I got home and I wrote it and I sent it to the Globe and Mail, and they, they said, can you add, do this? Can you edit it and everything? So then I edited it and they actually published it in September of 2009. So that was really my first foray into, I'd come from sports journalism, so I had to be a writer, but this was a very different way of writing personally. Mm. So it was 2009. So if you think of it back then, we really didn't have a lot of social platforms at all, but I had 25 or 24 people respond to that piece. Some were just awful and, just not nice people, but others were saying, thank you for sharing our story. And then it was that moment I realized, well, we're for sure not alone, but that the words that I was being able to use could actually maybe spur something in someone to be able to share their journey. So that kind of led me to start to do more research. So this was very early on, probably even before the piece was published, I started to reach out to medical professionals, psychiatrists, because I needed to understand what happened to Daniel. Because we came from a place of not even having conversations around mental health. I don't think the word suicide was really ever mentioned in our home. I didn't understand it as a health issue, because our focus as a family was on keeping Daniel alive because he had anaphylaxis. Mm. We were we were all over that as advocates. And, anyway, that was what I did when they were younger. Never understood what I was seeing, was right in front of me. And it was building over a period of at least two to three years. So I needed to, before, and it's all messed up, right? It's, grief is such a messy place. Losing a loved one is so messy. You just have to find a way to be okay with just this awful, awful place. It's awful. And so, but I had clarity when I was purposely doing something. And I thought, if I could find out, at least point to the beginning, the seeds of this, to his suicidal ideation, which was probably over a period of time, to his actual death by suicide, maybe that could help me accept to what degree I could accept losing him.
Can you tell us about Daniel? What was your son like?
Oh gosh. first off, he was so good looking. And I say that without any reservation. He was just this.
He was. I saw pictures.
And he, funnily enough, as he got older, started to, you know, play on that. And he would run into the bathroom while I was getting ready and putting makeup on her. He'd say, you know, you'd wish you looked as good as me, then you wouldn't have to put makeup on her. He knew how to push his mom's buttons in a way that nobody else did. And I lived on that. And he was our sense of humor. He would, you know, his dialects from watching SNL and just, he could sort of listen to someone's voice and then sort of copy that. And it just, we would be on the floor laughing. And he was also our fixer. To be honest, if we had problems within our own family, you know, fights or whatever, it was him that was trying to try to say, like, it's not that big a deal. Or he'd sit me down and say, just come and have breakfast with me. You don't have to go off and do that run. Like, take a break. And sometimes I didn't listen, but I did listen the last few weeks of his life. For some reason, he said, don't go and do that. I just want you to sit with me. And so I did, not knowing where he was, but obviously he needed somebody just to sit with him. And after his passing, there was so many young people reached out to us, and the stories that they would tell us, besides the hurt and their guilt, which I said, you cannot have guilt. You know, what you saw in front of you, or the fact that he would isolate himself, you didn't know that for what it was, but you know now. But the stories, you know, one girl said, it was one of his roommates, Daniel basically stayed up all night and listened to me after a breakup and then made me breakfast in the morning. Like he would just sit and listen to you. He had, in a way, he was one of those kind of sensitive guys who didn't act like he was sensitive, but I think a lot of the world affected him in different ways. And I've seen that in other young men that struggle, is they're very sensitive to the world, and women young women for that matter. They just they feel the world in a little bit different way.
Mm-hmm. I've been doing some research on trauma, and Dr. Gabor Mate, he talks about how we're all essentially traumatized or have traumatizing experiences, but depending on if you're a more sensitive person, right, it's how you respond or perceive those traumas that affect you. And so would you say that, you know, not knowing what his own personal traumas or experiences are that contributed to this, that his sensitivities alone could have been a contributing factor to just how he absorbed and perceived the world?
I absolutely do. And I think if I go back to what I have written in my book, was I look at early childhood negative experiences, and that was all around his physical health. He had quite severe asthma when he was very little. So we would be in the hospital for, you know, a couple days at a time, where he'd be, you know, sort of, you know, in an oxygen tent and different things like that. Because again, back then they didn't have a lot of the therapies that they use now, or even the things that can keep kids out of hospitals. So, you know, he was a little kid running around a kids ward and you know, couldn't get his breath. And you know, when he was a bit older and you added the life-threatening food allergies, well, he saw himself a lot of times from out. He was always looking in, couldn't just do what his buddies did. He just couldn't go for pizza or burgers. And the thing about Daniel is I think some of those things that are negative experiences, he actually turned them around to be a positive. He became a really good cook. I mean, he could create things from watching the Food Network that I couldn't even get close to. And so I would be his assistant in the kitchen. I think a person, especially a younger person, we have to understand that as they're growing up and their brain is forming and changing, and all these negative early childhood experiences can have a detrimental effect into early adulthood. And I recall when he was about 12, he was getting assessed, I think, just because he was having some problems. I think he wasn't ever diagnosed with dyslexia, but he could debate you all day, but he had trouble translating that to the written word. So we were trying to figure out how we could support him so that his English skills would up his game a bit. And I just remember him just like giving, he says, like he got very just down on himself. And I think even though we were trying to help him, it was a magnifying glass on whatever was not a deficit, but why he couldn't communicate with the written word. Well, over a period of about a year and a half, we got him a tutor, and that changed. Like he could write, he could actually start to communicate all the things that he could speak. Mm-hmm. So over time, and then other factors. So, you know, he's got these early life childhood experiences. He's got these health experiences that he has to be different. When he went off to, so grade 12, like, was a golden year. He had a great year. He you know, he was just doing so well. And he had a summer business. He was managing three or four employees for two summers. He got a grant, so which shows that you have to sort of demonstrate to this small business community that you're actually a little, you're a business owner. And so he was doing all the things, you know, that you could check off a list and say, you know, this person is functioning at a high level. Mm-hmm. He was an athlete. Before he went away to first year, that's late, later that summer, you could just see he was not in any way ready to go to university. He didn't say that. And after the fact, I can see that. I think the fact that he was struggling so much in school kind of just changed his outlook. And so instead of, you know, sort of reaching out and saying, you know, I think I need to, you know, I may need to talk to the tutor again, or I may need to get extra support academically, he started hanging out with these people, and they'd go over to Hull because he was in Ottawa, and, you know, they were drinking, and he had never really, that's just not was what his thing was. Mm-hmm. Basketball player, golfer. And a lot of kids do that. It's not the end of the world, but I think it became where he would not go to class. And so I think the way he started to look at himself, you know, you wake up and you're hungover, and you wake up and you haven't finished your assignments. You start to look at yourself. And I think a lot of self-hate starts to happen. You know, you think you're a burden. So that would have been, I guess, the fall of 2006. And so as a result, he ended up getting into we just assume, you know, once we recognize everything that happened, it took us a whole summer to actually get all of the information. We got him to go to a university closer to home, and we were closer to Toronto. So he got into the school and he appeared to be doing fine. But again, I think it's, he was also probably at this time actually struggling with a diagnosable, call it bipolar, something on that spectrum. Again, what we would see when he'd come home for weekends, or, you know, we'd text and say, are you coming home? Oftentimes he'd say, yeah, I'll be there. Mom, let's meet. We'll go get groceries. And that was great. And we would just see the sort of mania. We'd see the heightened, you know, energy and ready to do everything. Mm-hmm. On the times that, you know, we didn't come home, we'd learn later from his buddies that he'd say, I'll show up, never showed up. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he'd stay alone or stay isolated. So I think he was trying to figure it out, but he tried. Mm-hmm. I think when he would isolate himself and stay home, I think that burden of that is that your mind has lost the ability to sort of have this outside view of like, yes, today is awful. Mm-hmm. But this is not your future. This is a moment in time, regardless of if you have a diagnosable mental health condition or you do. This is a moment in time. And I think that's one of the reasons I became so vocal, was suicidal ideation is so fleeting. The act of one person dying by suicide is a fleeting moment. And doctors now are being instructed, especially our first, you know, our primary caregivers, is yes, we have to look after the mental health condition, but the person has to be, we have to keep them alive to be able to look after that underlying health condition. We have to find those therapies that will actually help to keep that person alive. Mm. And the support systems, which is to me just as important, because if perhaps Daniel knew that he could come to a compassionate family and say, I have considered taking my life, I need help. But he didn't have that language, you know, and because we would say things to him when he was, you know, because he was so highly functioning, we'd say like, Daniel, like, you've got everything. You just need to like focus. Mm. You can't tell someone who is struggling with a mental health disorder or, you know, sort of a fleeting condition, whatever that looks like, just that person, can't tell them to get their act together. They don't know what that looks like. You know, we might be able to process that. That's just basically like a wall, mm-hmm. you know?
There's so many factors you've said, you know, the early anaphylaxis and how that could be anxiety producing, and, you know, other challenges. And I'm drawn to what you said about him being a sensitive boy, and how the world doesn't really encourage sensitivity in boys, right? And so what do you do as a boy who has feelings and who is sensitive? How do you handle that? And so do you think at all about how gender socialization might have impacted him and his ability to ask for help, to speak out?
You know, I hear what you're saying, and I can answer this because Daniel and I had an extraordinary relationship. We talked about everything except his mental health. He would often talk to me about different lyrics, and he would, you know, whether it was Pearl Jam's Black, and he would talk to me about what the lyrics meant. And I was like, Daniel, why are you like, what about this is drawing, you know, you to want to listen to it. But I mean, we drove back to his school and it was on the radio. I just remember dropping him off, driving home to crying. I had nothing to cry about, but the lyrics alone were just haunting. So we talked about really deep things and deep issues. And he, only in hindsight, do I realize now that he was sharing a bit of his world, but almost as a third person, like this is happening to someone else. This isn't, I know a friend, and we actually had that conversation. And I really believe now that it was actually him who was struggling. And, you know, think of it this way. If me, who felt that we had the closest of close relationships with my son, but I didn't get that. I could see that he was starting to lose weight because his belt buckled, like the strap was hanging down. I said, like, what, how are you, why are you losing weight? Oh, it's no problem. He said, I haven't lifted weights. I'm going to go back to lifting weights. He always had an answer for me because he knew that's what I needed to hear. I didn't have the answer for him to help him save his life. And that will always haunt me because I could advocate for him all his life for his asthma and his anaphylaxis. I couldn't help him when he, and our family couldn't be there when he needed us most. You know, as I said, it haunts me. And I think and why I speak to you so often is because I just need them to understand that their life matters so much. And this is temporary.
Yeah, you talked about the suicidal ideation being sort of fleeting because it is this thing that happens in the minds, and then it can be turned off and your attention goes somewhere else and then it comes back again. But, you know, we've learned that people who decide to go through with it, it's that there's no other choice. Like this is the only choice that they have, right? To not be a burden, to save their families from hurt, to get rid of their extreme pain that they have, right? And so I know you're working to end suicide. And so how do we learn or teach or get to the place where we can say that there is another option? Where do we even start?
We start with understanding what mental illness looks like. We have to have education around what does someone who is losing weight, not doing the things that they normally would do, behaviorally changing drastically in front of your eyes. We have to understand what that looks like. It's not always just someone growing up. These could be the beginning. What is the symptoms of someone with a depression or anxiety or a combination of both or bipolar or an eating disorder? I think the burden is on us as parents, as friends, we who are mentally well. I think we owe it to ourselves to understand what that looks like. What does mental illness look like just generally? And you don't even have to go into specific disorders, but just what does this malaise start to change in your child or some, or your loved one? Once we start to understand that, then I think we're in a better position to actually compassionately not only care and, you know, figuratively and hold their hand through this crisis, but also reach out for the appropriate supports.
Because if you've never experienced depression, if you've never experienced anxiety, depression, or that feeling of lack of control, or the pain, or any kind of addiction, you or suicidal ideation, you have no idea how consuming it is, and how you cannot just tell the person to think positively, right? You have to. So it is our job, if we don't have that, to start to understand what the mental illness is what you're saying, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. And I basically used that thread when I did my TEDx talk, We Need to Talk About Suicide Prevention, because again, I'm drawing on our experience from not having a clue of what was happening right in front of us. There were alarms going off for several years. We couldn't put those together to understand that our son was in the fight of his life. And we had points on that journey that we could have intervened. We didn't know what we were dealing with.
So tell us about, because I know that you did go to your doctor because he was drinking heavily and you were worried about that. And then I heard that you said that your doctor had told you that he just needs to hit his own rock bottom, which is such an old, I mean, just a now devastating way of thinking, right? So tell us about that experience.
In of itself is just, the idea that this doctor who I I continue to see this doctor. It just shows you that our primary care providers are, in, you know, forget the pandemic, before the pandemic, have very little ability to understand because they just don't have the resources themselves to be able to support their patients when it comes to their emotional well-being. And A, it was Daniel will have to come himself, like he'll have to come.
Even
and
if he was, because he was over 18. Was over 18.
And just like the school doesn't have to inform you if your child isn't in school at over 18, so you don't even know if they're not going to school. And basically, the thing that will always just hurt is he said he has to hit rock bottom. Mm. Well, what does that look like for a young man, a young woman? Why should that be something that we want to attain mm-hmm. for someone who's young? You know, because rock bottom looks a lot different to a lot of people. And for us, it's obviously the worst.
Yeah. I think it also speaks to so many times people say, oh, they're just being teenagers or that's normal, right? If they isolate themselves in their room or they watch too much TV or social media, it's hard to tell what is normal teenage behavior and what is not, especially if you don't have that experience of mental illness yourself. Right. And so do you have any, Julie and I, we both have teenagers, there's 7 kids between the two of us. Do you have any tips, I guess, for parents who, to help them differentiate between what is, you know, normal teenage stuff and what isn't?
Well, the very first thing I would do is if you notice something that this has changed, whatever that's physical or behaviorally, I would just arm yourself with information and then have conversations with your kids. Just have these conversations that it's so normal. Normalize the conversation around mental health and mental wellness and also suicide and suicide prevention, because they may have a friend. What the kids are going through right now, this is like this storm of everybody's impacted in terms of all of our young people, that the young kids are having conversations with each other, which I'm thrilled about. But the point is, it's happening at such a rate in the home. I would say, like, have those conversations and encourage your kids to have conversations with their peers, because it's the peer-to-peer that really is what they're seeing in terms of in the professional setting, we'll say, is peer-to-peer support. Because if you have been down that road, you are much more likely to listen to somebody. If someone has been down that road, you're much more likely to listen to somebody. And so arm yourself as the parent, have the conversations in the home. But when you see something that is lasting longer than, I'd say, a month, something, whether it's agitation, it's isolation, just even the way they talk, the types of things that they're saying that they may not have said before, really listen to it, understand what they're viewing, you know, have a sense, if you can, of what they're looking at online. I think conversation, there is so much online because I this is just an anecdote, but a good friend of mine is going through a surgery this Wednesday. I was trying to reach out for mental health support for her for post-surgery. It's not easy. Mm-hmm. I never really got the opportunity to reach out for Daniel, but trying to navigate the system right now, it's really difficult. But there are a tremendous amount of particularly young adult and youth suicide prevention, mental wellness resources out there. But you should look at them, or we should be looking at them before we suggest them to our young people. Like, go and have a look for yourself and just, but the jack.org is great because they talk about these things and they communicate with young people. It's all about young people. Mm-hmm. Adults kind of not allowed. It's all about young people. So
I think another thing that, you know, I'm hearing you saying too is, and we, this podcast is about, often we talk about how as mothers, as women, we're taught out of our own intuition, right? Out of listening to our guts, out of, and right. I think that that's a really important part to this as well, is that, you know, part of it is your intuition. What you're saying is, as you're paying attention to the things that are happening for them, right? But we're often told, like, no, they're fine, or, oh, you know, just that's just normal, like Liz mentioned. But, you know, there are a couple of things that you did mention, you know, already, and having an awareness. And I think we're turning into a much more aware culture. So I think there's almost no excuse to not find that awareness anymore. But you mentioned the asthma and the anaphylaxis. I mean, I have two children who have anaphylaxis, and I know that we're all living in that state of heightened nervous system constantly. Yes. Yes. So if you have these little kids who are, from the time they're, you know, infants, being raised with this heightened, you know, sensitivity in their nervous system, that's automatically going to contribute to something potentially, who knows, in their future, but having that awareness. And then you've also talked about the drinking. You've also talked about mentioning the reckless and sort of repeated injurious behavior. So tell us a little bit about that sort of sign that we can maybe look out for as well.
So again, that's a tough one because, you know, kids like to do the things that kids like to do. Young adults like to do. Daniel was a boarder. He did all the boarding sports. I didn't realize that he would probably bash his head, you know, boarding. I mean, I know in the last year of his life, we were told this at a gathering after was on St. Patrick's Day, they boarded off a ramp off of one of the highways near Kitchener. Why are you doing it? Like, mm-hmm. But this injurious, and I've written about it, it's like the dulling of the more you do these sort of reckless, you sort of lessen the charge. So each time you kind of up the ante and you push the boundaries a little more. And of course I didn't see this because he was at school, but to do these kinds of things, it's putting yourself at such bodily risk. But there's a lack of care, and the more you do that, you lose that sort of boundary, and it's all
become fearless. Yeah,
and it's hopelessness, fearlessness, and feeling a sense of burden and isolation. If all those things are happening together, you have the deadly storm of suicide. Thomas Joyner writes about this. He lost his father to suicide, and he is a suicidologist, and he writes just volumes about sort of recognizing the different things. He's also a researcher, recognizing these things within our control, or not in our control, but what we can sort of see around us. And so if any of those, even one of those things are happening and you're witnessing it, I mean, that's an alarm. That's cause to try to turn that train around. You know, I look at Daniel and I think Liz alluded to it earlier. There is a complete loss of hope for tomorrow. Like you are completely hopeless. And the pain that one feels living with depression, like I haven't experienced it. The closest I've come is the depression that I went into after losing Daniel.
You mentioned the pandemic, and certainly the pandemic has not been helpful for mental health for anyone, and especially for young people. About 70%, according to SickKids, of school-aged children to teenagers have reported a decline in mental health during the pandemic. You know, you're talking about things that need to happen in the home in terms of supporting children. What other changes would you like to see happen to support the mental health of our children?
Just if we look at school-aged children, is that we, family, but also teachers, coaches, people that our kids come in contact with a lot when they're younger, these should be part of the discussions. We talked about health in school. Mental health and wellness, I think, is becoming much more part of understanding, so the young person can understand that if this is going on for 2 weeks, a month, like maybe I should be reaching out for help. Letting young people, especially when they're very young, like I'm talking 8 and 10 years old, know that if you feel this way, the burden shouldn't be on you, that it's your fault. This is something that's happening to you and you really don't have any control over it. Offering them that they do have the control of trying to reach out or talk to a parent, talk to a friend, but not to stay with it on their own, because they can't look after themselves on their own. Like this, they have to reach out for support. And you know, talking to a young adult, talk to a friend. You know, you don't want to talk to your parent, speak out to a friend, reach for an online support service, Crisis Canada. They've got 24/7 text or phone, kids help phone. There are resources out there that you don't have to sit there and have this sort of self-hate just daily.
So do you feel that the resources are out there? Like there's a good amount of resources out there, and then there's just a lack of being able to know where to go or to ask for help. Is that what you see is going on? Or does there need to be an increase in resources too, I'm wondering?
You know, Liz, I don't know that I can speak to should there be more. I think the resources are reasonably adequate. I think there needs to be a back end so that when someone is not necessarily in a crisis to go into emergency care, because that doesn't always end well, mm-hmm. is to have these online resources, but also be able to have the mental health care that young people require that is affordable or free. And I think that back end has to be the piece to me, because, you know, we're telling our kids to reach out, but when they reach out, where do we as parents or friends support them? Where do we get them next? I think the services right now online, on social media and things like that are somewhat adequate for sure. But I think our mental health delivery needs to change. At some point, if someone is really in a crisis, as I said before, emergency, they need other care. They need, whether it's psychiatry, they need psychologist, a counselor.
which we have to pay for. I mean, just speaking personally, I've sought support and I've had to pay for it, which is fine. I'm lucky I can pay for it, but a lot of people can't.
Well, Canadian Mental Health Association has a program where you can just, basically it's a drop-in. And you can just basically look at their hours in the region that you're in, and then you can drop in. You can call ahead, but you can drop in for mental health support.
Okay.
So that is free. You know, it's $150 to $200 an hour. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's out of reach for most people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it is good to know that there's the free resources, the drop-ins, the online stuff, the kids' help phone, I know. But I'm still wondering if, as you mentioned, the delivery of this information is still lacking because of the stigma that still exists out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, even though the kids' help phone is there, what, like, are kids actually going to be reaching out? Because let's talk about the stigma around it.
So I would say they are reaching out, but not every kid is going to be reaching out. Because you think if you're in some sort of crisis and in a full blown depressive state, you don't have the capacity to reach out. So that's why I go back to, we have to sort of understand what's happening to our family members. Mm-hmm. But for sure, I think people are much more open in open forums to share about their mental illness or their episodes, but we're not reaching everybody. You know, even when we, you know, I'm part of a group and we, you know, sort of did a meet and greet a little while ago, and people were sharing left, right, and center, to the point that I felt triggered a bit, because I would be absorbing all of these stories. But the other side of it was, this is incredible that people feel so vulnerable, and like being vulnerable is such a positive thing, because by doing so, you will get care, you'll get support. I think we're doing an okay job of destigmatizing it, but I know 12 years ago, like, people didn't even want to mention the word suicide. Even mental health or mental illness, it's a reality, and a lot of us have to live with it. And mm-hmm. some of you that don't think you will, you may have to. So mm-hmm. we have to find ways, and I'm not sure how to get there, but we have to keep talking about it, keep normalizing it. In not only our family settings, online, and ladies are on all the different media platforms, it appears that it is pretty normalized, but that's for people that are on those platforms. Mm-hmm. They're okay to share. They're okay to talk about it or post boards about it. Think about all those people that aren't on those platforms and who are struggling and don't have an outlet. You know, maybe they'll listen to a podcast, or maybe they'll watch something on television. We have to continue to get the people that don't feel so hopeless. But they also have this sense that they're not worthy. Mm. And I think we have to really say, every life matters.
Mm, I love that. Yeah. Every life matters. You've spoken as well about the potentially increased stigma in Black communities. So people who are listening to this podcast, they might not know that you're a mixed race person. I've heard you identify as mixed race in the past. And I've heard you speak about the additional challenges in Black communities around speaking about mental health. So could you just talk a little bit about that?
The BIPOC community has special challenges just surviving in society today. It goes back to many things. And one of it is sharing about something so personal, especially young Black men. You know, it sort of devalues you. You're not a strong person. And it happens in the white community as well. But it's very hard for Black community to access care. There's probably just like the other parts of our community trying to access mental health care. Well, it's even harder mm-hmm. in underserved communities. They don't necessarily have a Canadian Mental Health Association on their block or within walking distance. Mm-hmm. So underserved communities need to have more supports on the ground, whether they're even sort of like drive-in community, you know, drive-in trailers where they have these sort of on the spot pop-ups. We just have to get more inventive on how we can bring support systems to underserved communities. Today is a really hard day in the BIPOC community, just because of all the racial tension around the world, but particularly in North America. And I think if we look at access to care in the Black community, and then also just the hesitancy from people of color to share, mm-hmm. to speak up. If you think of being Black and being a person of mixed race, you don't know it as a child, but you grow up realizing that you have to try harder, be better, look different, adapt to others all your life. And you don't always necessarily get that until you are an adult. I know speaking for myself, I think it's a little, people are learning a lot younger these days. I think they're catching on and they're pushing back. Mm-hmm. But for most of my life, I think I've recognized I've adapted to others or conformed to others. And I'm not, I'll challenge people on anything. It's not that it's just that I find myself adapting to others. And I've done that probably a good chunk of my life. And I think when you are a mixed race or in the BIPOC community, that's your challenge, is to say, screw you. This is who I am. This is my place. I'm going to take space. As my older daughter, Amy, told me, you take your space.
Yeah, I love that.
And she lives in New York and she knows what she's talking about.
Well, and this is your lived experience, and nobody can take that away from you, right? Other people who are completely not in your world, your environment, your life, right? Like they're particularly as a white woman, I have no idea what that's like, right? So nobody can take that away from you. So I appreciate that. I think that that's a very powerful thing, especially as we are getting older, to start to realize that, where you can sort of step into who you are. And so I'm curious about, we talked a little bit about your running, and you started running and running after your son's death, but what are some other, along with the running, some other sort of self-care tools that you are using right now currently to continue to, fuel and feed yourself and be in your own power?
In the start of the pandemic, I started to meditate. I had time. And so I just looked at online supports, met up with a meditation coach and sort of found my way to do it on my own. I do it with the Unsinkable community, with Pamela. She does daily or weekly meditation. So I found that really, I found taking time to just be still really important, because I found, and I don't know if you found this, but through the pandemic, it was like this, oh, I can't sit. I have to get stuff done. I've got to plan my dinner like at 10 o'clock in the morning. Because it's like this, if I sit still, I'm going to be lazy, or I'm just not going to get stuff done. And I think through the pandemic, I know I've evolved to realize, okay, just relax. It'll get done. I can take some time. You know, I don't have to learn how to make all the kinds of muffins and cookies today. I can just take, do one at a time. So I learned overall to just try to get one or two things done in a day, whether it's through the advocacy, the activism, I get up in the morning and I do train pretty much first thing. I take my dog for a walk and then I do whatever training, piece for the day. Then I'll try to do some writing, which has been really hard to get focused on that for some reason. I have a lot of extra time, but I'm trying to write a running book, and I'm actually having a hard time entering it. And I've got all these different avenues to enter in, because I've had this like over 20 years of meeting the most incredible humans and interacting with, people through a race that we've done for 17 years in Muskoka for kids. And it's just like meeting Bono at the end of a race. Like there's just like all these little anecdotes, it's more just like the run journey and what can happen on it. And it's, it's for myself initially, but maybe someone will find some interest in it.
I'm sure they will. And I'm drawn to that contrast between meditating and being still and running and moving, right? The stillness and the movement. And I'm curious how running supported you, especially maybe during those early runs, right? Just recently after Daniel's passing, how did running support you during that time?
Yeah, I think I just could be alone with my thoughts. I could be really selfish with my thoughts. You guys are moms, and your child is everything to you. Your kids are everything. And I think I could actually go out, I could run and just like scream. Mm. I could just like,
would you scream? Would you scream?
Oh, totally. I mean,
Liz does that too.
I run too. That's why I'm asking. Cause I run, I cry, I punch things, punch, I fist punch. I do. I'm crazy. I look like a mad person when I'm running, but that's healing for me. I'm curious.
And funny when you say that, cause the first run that I did after losing Daniel was about 3 days after. And I screamed and it scared me. Because it was so primal. And the night that he didn't come home, he was at our cottage and we were at home, and we didn't know the next day, but I remember walking out the front door and screaming for him. And it was this like deep earthy mother just come home primal scream. So I just found running was it was the only thing that I could do that was moving forward, because everything I did was stepping backwards. Whether it was going back to find out what his life looked like, everything was backwards, or remembering what we were as a family of five. Running was physically moving forward. I guess that's the best way to put it. I have a short anecdote, if you have time. I don't know if you It's just, this is the power of running to me and why I will never stop running unless my body says so. I had been training for a full marathon. The week we lost Daniel, I knew I couldn't run it, obviously. But on Mother's Day, which was about 2 weeks after we lost, or no, a week after we buried Daniel, I somehow got to the start line of a marathon. I chose to run the half. I had to run. I had to do it. I had to be immersed with people that didn't know me and just like, I had to feel something other than just chronic pain, just this over up with this emotional and my heart and my was so broken that. So I started the race and I don't even remember how I got there, to be honest. I don't know if my brother husband took me or if I got there myself, but I got the bib. I started the race, finished the race, posted my second fastest time, which I don't even know how that would have ever happened. Got home, got into Daniel's truck, and I read his note that he left to us. Up until that point, I didn't have the ability to dig deep, to dig any deeper. And I found it through that running gave me that window of about an hour to go back and read his final words. I mean, it, you know, sent me into a tailspin after, but I could not have done that if I didn't do that race. If I hadn't put myself in that position, because that took so much courage. I didn't even realize it, but it's not even where you say I'm courageous. It's not that. It's when we're forced to dig deeper than we've ever been, we all find the courage that we were born with. We all have it. I just never unpacked it until I had to. And so I believe that running actually helped me sort of to find that place and just gave me that opening to spend a few minutes with his note and really understand that he felt awful about what was about to happen.
I mean, I hear that running gave you courage and the ability to move forward. And I'd like to send you this recording because you said some powerful things about what running means to you, and that might help you with your book just in terms of what you want to communicate through it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I want to say. So thank you.
I am taking away that just deep sense of courage that you have in taking such a devastating experience and really, you know, doing some good for the world, right? You are an activist in this area. You're working hard to, you know, eliminate suicide altogether. And what I think a message that we want people to know out there is that, like, you have a beautiful family. You are a supportive mother. You had an incredible relationship with your child. This is not a situation of abuse, or you know what I mean? Like there's this really lovely, beautiful picture of a story of a family of five who.
And Daniel was thriving too, right? In a lot of ways.
And so.
He had a good life until he didn't.
Yeah. And so it is that, you know, what you were speaking to is the awareness of the little signs and things that can happen and can trigger. And that mental illness is a really devastating piece to what gets you to this place. So I'm so grateful that you have taken what is, you know, and has been so devastating for you and really turned it into something for all of us to learn from and to grow from and to, you know, change the world in a better way. So first of all, thank you for that. And second of all, our podcast is called The Afterglow, and you know, you have had multiple afterglows throughout this whole experience as you've talked about. But wondering if you have other goals or other dreams or other desires for yourself moving forward, and what your afterglow might be.
Gosh, I feel like I'm living it. I feel like I'm kind of present in it right now, because I really feel that everything that I thought I would get to do with my kids, and that's obviously changed. I'm really present in my daughter's lives. We're incredibly close. We always have been, and I continue to stay present. I have the ability and the privilege to be able to write, which is to me grace. I'm training. My body at the age of 63 still wants to do an Ironman.
You're not 63.
Wow. our listeners cannot see.
Oh my God. So, beautiful woman. Yeah. Strong fit.
Like I noticed it says, up to 60, but I think, listen, like the podcast could be.
We'll make an exception for you.
We're not just up to 60. Don't worry.
I feel, I feel like in some ways, I guess this is my, my only shot at pity on myself is, I feel like my 50s, I got robbed a little bit. And so I, in Daniel's absence, I made a promise to both of us, to him and to me, that I would share his story so that another person may be spared and another family may have the future with their loved one. And then I also said to Daniel to give me a nod, give me a sign when I've done everything I can in his name. And it still hasn't given me that sign. So I feel like I'm still really going to pursue advocacy. I've got a really exciting project coming up. I can't share it, but I will share it with you as soon as I know. And hopefully before you air, I can share it with you. And it's something I've not done, so that I'm excited about that. And it's basically mental health and youth. And the project now is really near and dear to me, because if we ever could get to a point where one region was spared suicide in a year, that would be a model for the world. And so Project Now is seeking to do that. And so I'm on board as one of the sort of the experiential members on the group. So
amazing. Lynn, amazing. Your courage and your resilience, your ability to take such a challenging, adverse situation and turn it into an act of service and love for others in the world is truly inspirational. So thank you for being here with us today. And we're really excited to share your story. We encourage our listeners to check you out also at lynnkeen.ca. And is there another platform you'd like them to look
at? I'm on Twitter and Instagram.
Okay, perfect.
My name and they'll get it. But I was interested, you said something about what you would tell your 15-year-old self.
Yeah, we'd love you to answer that question.
Because that's really what I want to write about in my book too, is I would tell 15-year-old Lynn that you are way stronger than you ever believe you will be.
Beautiful.
And I think if we knew that when we were younger,
You are strong. Beautiful, Lynn. Thank you so much for being
thank
here.
You.
That's a wrap for this episode of The Afterglow. Yet another courageous Canadian sharing her vision.
Do us a favor and lift a sister up by sharing this podcast with others who want to find their afterglow. And let us know, what do you want to hear about? Who do you want to hear from? And what is your afterglow? Slide on into our DMs at The Afterglow Podcast Official and leave us a message.
Did you love this podcast? Be sure to like and rate us on Spotify and iTunes and wherever you tune in. Until next time.